You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting to Yes And.
You want to come see us talk live on the Getting to Yes And podcast? Well, I'm going to be talking to Keegan-Michael Key, Second City alum, and L. Key about their new book, The History of Sketch Comedy, A Journey Through the Art and Craft of Humor, on October 5th at 7 p.m. at the Francis Parker School. This is part of the Chicago Humanities Festival. If you want to get tickets, go to chicagohumanities.org. My guests today on the podcast are Frances Fry and Ann Morris. Frances is a returning guest. She's a professor at Harvard Business School. She served as Uber's first senior vice president of leadership and strategy to help the company navigate its very public crisis in leadership and culture. She regularly works with companies embarking on large-scale change and organizational transformation, including embracing inclusion and diversity as a lever for improved performance. Ann Morris is a leadership coach and the executive founder of the Leadership Consortium, a first-of-its-kind leadership accelerator that works to help more and varied leaders thrive. Her collaborators have ranged from early-stage tech founders to Fortune 500 executives to public sector leaders building national competitiveness. She spent the last 20 years building and leading mission-driven enterprises, serving most recently as CEO and founder of GenePeaks, which addressed the urgent need for better personal health information. And they have a new book. It's called Move Fast and Fix Things, The Trusted Leader's Guide to Solving Hard Problems. Love talking to them. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another letter left unsaid. Days can't be counted by time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Frances Fry and Ann Morris, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kelly. We're thrilled to be here.
So in the preface for your new book, you write, quote, "A cornerstone of our work is that leadership is the practice of imperfect humans leading imperfect humans," end quote. And I think this is actually a really important presupposition with regard to leadership and business that many leaders likely believe, but don't use that particular insight to inform their actions as a leader. So, Anne, does that make sense to you, what I'm saying?
Yes, we have found it to be a very liberating phrase in the work that we do. In part, I think, because a lot of people, and Frances and I have been, well, Frances, I will only speak for me in this delightful conversation, but fall into this idea that there is some kind of perfection, end of the rainbow, end state for leadership. And because there is none, I'm here to just break the fantasy, break someone's heart out there. We end up performing leadership instead of actually leading. And this phrase, it's fast, but it's a quick release from that kind of performative leadership, which is based on the fantasy that there is some kind of perfection when there's not.
I would also add, Kelly, that, you know, the burden of perfectionism, I'm not sure that it hits all people equally. I know I've been liberated from it my whole life, and it feels like it's been a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of people, though, that suffer from the burden of perfectionism for themselves and then for others, like in their judgment of others. And so Anne's word is perfect there. The liberation and the optimization that can come on top of that liberation, it's like what a low ceiling perfectionism gives to everyone. And when you just get to take the roof off on it. So it's really that you drew your attention to it. It's exactly, I think, a beautiful point in the beginning of the book.
Well, I was thinking, go ahead.
Go ahead, Kelly. Go ahead.
I was thinking about this in the context of, so I was a very young leader at Second City. I became the boss here when I was 26, and I was not like qualified. And my now wife, Anne, who was my then friend, Anne, I asked her for one piece of advice. And the advice she gave me was, you're going to be wrong a lot. Just make sure you say you're sorry. Mm. And that to me is sort of core here. But what I'll say about that is I did follow that, but I don't know that I believed it until I was older and sort of, you know, kept coming across the evidence and the literature. And then that matched up with the experiences. And so this idea, whether it's the irrationality of human beings, the infallibility, you know, that we're all fallible creatures, that sort of thing, it is quite liberating, but there is so much stacked against us in terms of the stories we're told, the movies, the TV, the books, and our own, I imagine, all of our own experiences from the jobs we take, that we took, from whether you're like, I was a, you know, bagger at a grocery store, and I was already being exposed to sort of not great leadership behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the stories we're told, and it's also the stories we tell and we decide to believe that I think get in the way of getting this right. So this story that I'm supposed to be really good at this, you know, at age 26 or 45 or wherever your starting point is, can get in the way of getting really curious about where what you're doing is working and not working. And that curiosity piece is really central to the work we do. The sentence that follows the one that you quoted was about this being the jumping off point for imperfect organizations.
Yeah.
And that's really what we're interested in. We're interested in the outcome of the hard truth that we are all flawed, and those imperfections are reflected then in the organizations that we build. And when you start there, when that's not your dirty little secret that you're dragging into the office, when that's the starting point and it happens to be a universal starting point, then you're free to go figure it out. You know, what's working? What's not working? How do we run an experiment to get to a better place together? And how do I bring other people along? Because we sometimes get pulled into this idea that it is our secret that we're not getting everything right.
It's so nice. The slope of improvement, if you start with we're imperfect, is so much steeper than the slope of improvement if you assume perfection.
It's right. Yeah. I'm curious about, so the way the book is organized is by days of the week. So this is a Monday through Friday book. Weekends we take off, and we will get to that. But I am curious why you made that choice. I mean, and on the one hand, if we're talking about moving quickly, using, but not like everything's going to happen right today, it does insist that, like, well, if you look at it in a week, you're giving yourself a sort of a mental model. Well, I'm curious, Frances, I'll start with you on this. What were you guys thinking when you came up with that idea?
The observation was that people permit or allocate way too much time for change. So, and when we look at how much is uptime versus downtime, so like let's say somebody allocated themselves a year to do something, and then we look backwards at that year. Oh my gosh, the times that they were actually doing the thing, if you compressed that, super small percentage, and the time they weren't doing it in that year, a lot. And so then we were like, well, does it matter? Like, does it matter that I go on off all year? And it does. That because what the organization will be receiving from you are mixed messages. So much better to wait until you're ready to do it and then do it. And don't do it in the mornings and then that. Don't do it every other week. Do it. And then it turns out that the doing it is much closer to a week than any other unit of analysis. When we started writing the book, we even broke it down to hours. Like, here's what you'll do from 9 to 10 and 10 to 11. That was too much. But we even went to that granular place.
Well, and that is, to my mind, making it a practice. You know, and this is what we talk about with improvisation, is you're not just suddenly going to be good at this, like anything. And it's always going to be in flux. And it's not going to be so daunting if you just recognize that that is a practice that you have as a human walking through this world.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And we love to say, you know, you do the week, take the weekend and start all over again is really the practice. Yeah. I mean, we quote this in the book and all the time, but no one has ever said to us, you know, I wish I had taken longer and done less. No one ever. So if that's the jumping off point, then well, what does it look like to actually move fast? And that's the challenge we gave ourselves for this book. How do you move fast and not break things? Because the prevailing ethos in our world is that it's inevitable. And that assumption wasn't lining up at all with our experience. Mm-hmm. So we really gave ourselves a challenge of like turning this into a playbook. And as we had fun with it and fun with the idea, well, how much time do you need and how much time do you think you need and how do we close that gap? This week form came into view for us. And then it's also fun and it's memorable. And we are being both playful and deadly serious about how much you can actually accomplish in a week.
It's astonishing how much can be accomplished in a week.
Yeah. All right, let's start with Monday. So you ran the book.
Monday. Quote, good morning, everybody.
Yeah, right. It's Monday.
Is it Monday yet, Kelly?
And it happens to be actually Monday that we're taping. So you say in the book, quote, Monday's ambition is to find the problem, a gritty little word we often dilute and defang in the American workplace, replacing it with more palatable substitutes like issue or opportunity, end quote. And this reminded me of that idea of Danny Kahneman sees the world as a problem, and that is his particular kind of superpower. So I think that's that you're trying to do a reframe of problem here, right?
Yeah, and that problem is such an honest statement. And, you know, when I don't know who converted problems to opportunities, but it really, I think the defanging is right. Like we were almost afraid to confront that we had a problem. So we're going to call it something softer. Yeah. And I just don't think it's necessary. Like if it's necessary, if you don't know how to solve problems and if you're afraid of problems, but if you know how to, it'd be like, if I see a pothole, I'm going to call it something else. Well, I would only do that if I don't know how to, you know, fill and smooth over potholes, but I do. So let's not do it. So I think that's really where it came from, is that we somehow got afraid of problems as opposed to problems are fixable. Like really, really hard problems are fixable if we just bring our can-do spirit to it.
And Anne, I imagine you had to start with Monday, because if you're not ready to admit that there's problems, the rest of the week kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah, for sure. It's the starting point, is getting curious and being honest about the fact that some things are not working. You know, there's potential here we're not meeting. And to us, it's just a much more honest word than some of these synonyms and some of the corporate speak that has become part of the lexicon that actually gets in the way of progress. The reality is that you and your people are experiencing the world in terms of problems, in terms of things that need to be fixed. And when we use the honest language around that, I think we can meet people and organizations where they are. And that's what we are trying to do.
Because, for example, we want fewer problems. Do we really want fewer opportunities? Like, they don't work as substitutes.
That's interesting. You know, we talk in our work about replacing blame with curiosity as a way to enter in this space. And it's this chapter, it's all about curiosity being that thing of like maybe the number one tool you have when you're going in to solve these problems, right?
Yeah. And that you want to, the other part of here is that the presenting problem is only occasionally the actual problem. So I was just earlier today talking with a group that we were talking about speed, and they were like, oh no, we went so fast, we have to slow down. Like the speed was the problem. And I was like, okay. And how did you know that speed was the problem? Well, because we aren't coordinated well with one another. So when we go fast, that accelerates it. I was like, so you have a coordination problem. You don't have a speed problem. You have a coordination problem. Mm-hmm. Let's identify that. And then let's fix that. And then your speed is no longer the problem. So I think it's the find the real problem,
right,
is the Monday, so that we can get down to what's the culprit.
That's interesting. It makes me, one of those exercises that we I'm sure you've seen us do this before, because it's almost always at the beginning of one of our workshops, we do a red ball exercise where it's a fictional ball that people are passing around. Then we add another ball of another color, and basically sort of teaching people this is complex, but there are real things you can do to handle the complexity. It's not beyond you.
Right.
And that's such an important sort of instrumental first step for you to then work as a group to solve the problem.
Yeah. We find that there's a lot of power in the world. We find that there's a lot of power in the word because it implies that there's a solution.
Yeah.
I like in this chapter, you talk about, you ask the question, has someone built a house of no? So I imagine you've met those kinds of architects.
In every organization we've ever been a part of and ever worked with.
There's a lot of no. And look, no can be a great thing.
Good people who their role is the protectors of the institution. It's not their fault they get invited to meetings they shouldn't be invited to.
Yeah. And that's a place where we find curiosity can be really powerful of okay, so can we infiltrate the house of no and understand really what the motivation is behind the no? Because I'm wired to get really frustrated by that and want to tunnel around it, but have had some of the most powerful conversations I've had in my career is being really direct and getting curious and trying to show up in that conversation without judgment. What is this stakeholder trying to preserve? And what is he or she afraid of in this change journey? I'm going to use the word journey unironically multiple times in this conversation, Kelly.
I love it. Me too.
Yeah. So what's the fear? And can I lean into that and understand it? And then can we resolve the fear rather than just shutting down progress in the name of this boogeyman that we don't even know who's also in the room?
Right. Well, so, and you need to do that on Monday, because then Tuesday you tackle a very small thing, which is called trust. it's not small at all. Francis, I actually want you to start us on this exercise that you do in your class around the electric maze, because I think that's a very good illustration of how maybe you get at this.
Yeah. And so the electric maze is this wonderful exercise, and Amy Edmondson introduced me to it, where we lay out a carpet that has, I don't know, maybe 8 by 15 squares on it. And each square is like 1 foot by 1 foot. So you can step on the squares. A square either beeps or doesn't beep when you step on it. So it's got invisible differentiation, but otherwise they look identical to each other. And what we just task students with is you have to find the non-beeping path, consecutive path through the maze. And then we put some constraints on for pedagogical reasons that only one person can be on the maze at a time. Mm-hmm. And if you find a beep and the beep tells you it's wrong, you have to get off, go to the end of the line, and the next person goes on. And what we will see is when a person is on the maze, other people are like super animated about where they should go next. Nobody knows where they should go next. So everybody is super animated about where they should go next and very opinionated, where it is not knowable. So what happens is the participants and essentially end up freezing. It's like they're playing freeze tag.
Right.
They're frozen and they're like, should I be this one, and this one? And so they're waiting for what feels like an eternity, and no new information can be learned during that wait. So what you should be doing is like earnestly seeking new beeps. So just experiment, find new beeps. And when there is the only sadness that should happen is if it's an old beep. Well, you should. So the room, very opinionated, forces people to slow down when they're going for new beeps. And when they hit a new beep, everyone like turns their back. We take pictures of it when the animated, the video of people turning their back and like shaming the person on the maze for finding a new beep, which was not knowable and is indeed progress. So this we find to be like, our goal is to find new beeps. Like that is a very valiant thing to do. And that you finding new, if you worried about failures, old beeps are the ones that you want to figure out how to have
That's
good
right.
processes in place.
It's such an improv thing. Make mistakes work for you. This is like, and there, it like the not laugh is terrific, because you know not to do that thing again.
Yes. I love that phrase, make mistakes work for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such an improv thing.
It's so counterintuitive, Kelly, which is why we also talk about NerdWallet's fail wall in the book, in that we really have to overcome our human wiring and the socialization that leads us to the assumption, my job is to avoid mistakes at all cost. This is why it's such a powerful metaphor for leadership. No, the only way you're getting through that maze is if you and your people are making mistakes, but very deliberately learning from those mistakes. That's the fastest path through. But we really do have to overcome our instincts to get there.
So I was reading the book and I came across this next section.
It's nice to hear someone say that.
I know. It's so exciting. Yeah, we're still at the point in this whole process where it's really exciting for us to hear someone even say that.
Exactly. Read the book. Yeah. Well, you'll enjoy this part. So, so I came across this little section and I'm like, oh no, this is good stuff. And so I started sending it to people, and you titled the first sentence here is, quote, while the context of every firm is novel, its problems tend to be more commonplace, end quote. I want to read out this list. And I'm going to read out this list because when I sent it to my friend Jen, who's across the hall, she says, well, I feel seen and attacked. let me read it. So here's the list that is the problems that tend to be more commonplace. Aversion to making choices, reliance on heroic employees, shiny object syndrome, disengaged middle management, casual relationships with other people's time. I'm going to say that one again. A casual relationship with other people's time, comfort with collateral damage, high incidence of the Sunday scaries, also a good one, people pleasing in the boardroom, tolerance for misalignment, and delusions of meritocracy. I mean, that's mean.
So the people that are hearing this can't see, but Anne is doing a victory lap in. So Anne is the top 10 list, just genius.
Yeah.
And those, I wake up in the morning after she does, and there'll be a new top 10 list. And I have the same reaction that you do, Kelly, when I read it.
Yeah. You feel seen and attacked?
No.
So Anne, what's saving us from not
Francis
being so depressed?
I'm sorry, say it again.
What's saving us from being completely depressed after reading that list?
Oh, Monday through Friday, Kelly. Like this is the whole, we got to create a little tension and just acknowledge the problem here. And then here's in 5 days of effort and the thing that we, our publisher pushes us on, but we clarify every time, we are deadly serious about the amount of progress you can make in a week.
Yeah.
Our publisher will say can you soften it a little bit? Can you just, And of course we're going to give you more than a week if you need it, but we really want you to take us quite literally in the beginning, just for the muscle memory of how much further down the path you can be when you spend a dedicated 8 hours on Monday's activities, a dedicated 8 hours on Tuesday's activities. It actually is quite a substantial amount of time, and you will be shocked by how far you can get.
I think your use of humor in the book is crucial because this is real serious, tough stuff. Is it Suzuki who said, these things are too serious not to joke about them? You know, this idea of, that's a tough list. And the fact that my friend Jen responded with that, with a joke, which is perfect because but that also, you gotta knock that off. And in this section, this is what I want to ask you about, Francis, which is, why was Apple not happy with your slides?
Kelly, can I just respond to what
Please.
You said about humor? Because we use it all the time in our work, partly because we can't stop ourselves because it's just currency that I think we both use to go through the world in different ways, but also because we really need to invite the whole person into this process. And the fastest path to authenticity in our experience is to laugh with other human beings.
Sure.
It is the emotion you really can't fake. as people have observed. And it really, that really resonates with our experience. So the book is littered with moments where we just made ourselves laugh in the process of writing, where we tried to make each other laugh in the process of writing the book. But there really is a pedagogical value to it, because if we can connect to that part of you and invite you into this conversation with us, then we're far more likely to get somewhere together.
We're also of the Julia Louis-Dreyfus school of thought, which is everything, every single thing can be made better by laughter.
Yeah. Shortest distance between two people is a laugh.
It's absurd. I mean, life is absurd. And this part of life is absurd, where we create these ridiculous organizations and then we're stuck with them and we got to figure out how to make them better. And that's often a hilarious pursuit, because all of our humanity gets exposed along the way.
That's right. All right. So why did Apple have a problem with your slides?
hilarious moment.
Well, in their defense, I think a lot of people would have a problem with my slides.
A lot of people have some of their slides.
In their defense, the slides remain ridiculous.
Okay, fair.
They're not, you know, I would have people who would come into my classroom after I would teach, and they would say, I guess you could call those boards. the presentation part is has not been the part where I focused on, and so they would be look like they were made by children.
Okay.
So I think, and this was the thing that they take aesthetic, and I'm a devoted Apple consumer. They take the aesthetic very seriously. But on the serious side, they really did make me think, oh, you guys only have people like you talk to you. Ah, this is going to be so good. And then it turned out to be a beautiful, beautiful conversation.
Yeah. I mean, you still didn't change the slides. So,
So Francis, yeah. What's the story? You sent the slides over, and what did they say?
Oh, they said you can't use these slides when you
in
come
your talk.
Apple. In my talk, I can't use these slides. And I said, oh, awesome. Don't touch them. And you've now given me the beginning frame of my conversation.
So did you not use the slides and just talk?
Of course I used the slides.
You used the slides?
Of course I used them. And I'm not... Of course.
So when I don't
understand the question, Kelly. I don't even understand the question.
I get it. I don't... When I go speak, I don't use slides, period. And people always get confused to me. It's like, what are you going to have up there? I go, I'm going to have me, the reason you brought me, talk to you. And I'm like, I can give you some evidence that I know around the power of the human voice, about the fact that it's going to be multitasking and that sort of thing. And it's not to say I haven't. I've used them in other kinds of presentations that have worked, well. But it is funny how for certain kinds, they hold on to the PowerPoint in a way that actors will hold on to things. I remember Mick Napier, who's a director here, once telling me that he meets with the cast before they start rehearsing a new show, and they're all writers and performers here. And often, very often, he'll have a female performer who says, I really want to play the cello in the show. Like, I play the cello, I want to show that. And he's like, absolutely, 100% you're going to play the cello in the show, with no intention for them to ever play the cello on the show. And what they're really doing is holding on to something that they have a skill at, thinking that as they enter into the unknown, at least they have that thing. And he's like, I'm happy for you to have the illusion that that's going to help you. It's not going to matter in the long run.
Well, I would say I'm on your side of the fence. I'm a slide light person. There are some things where I still need slides, and those look like children made them. And they could even be useful to a company with the design, one of the best design ethics in the world, ethos, I guess, in the world of Apple. But that was a wonderful moment. It was a wonderful pedagogical moment.
I love it. All right, Wednesday. Wednesday is about making new friends.
Oh, it is. And Wednesday is, it's really, so you came up with your idea, you've solved for trust at the center of it, and now you're going towards the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And my goodness, your solution will be infinitely better if you can expand the inputs that you get. So we want to make new friends. We want to make novel friends. I don't want to make another friend that's just like me. I want to make different friends than me. I want to add glorious different perspectives and experiences to the table. And that gives us a much better chance of coming up with a great solution. So if you only have a few people, you're going to have a limited solution. But if you have a breadth of pick your favorite breadth, you're, oh my gosh, the upper envelope of what you can come up with, it just goes up and up and up in a nonlinear way. So make very new friends.
And I was thinking about this, that when you think about groups of people, so when you talk about improvisation, we talk about groups of people making something out of nothing. That is also what you're talking about. And that's what we talk about in business and almost all these different endeavors.
Right.
You're not going to, if you go to an orchestra and it's all violin players, I think it's going to not just be boring, but you're not gonna be able to create the kind of music you want. If you go to a soccer game or a basketball game or a baseball, it's like there's, you need all these different skills and all these different things to make things work. And I'm just so curious why the business world still seems to need convincing that.
Oh, because we really like people who are really like us, Kelly.
Yeah.
We really do. And it's, and that's at an instinctual and cellular level. So unless we interrupt that with the learned behavior of seeking difference, oh my goodness, we really like people who are really like us. I don't condemn anyone. It appears to me to be human nature for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also think we're midway through the story, and midway through this story of diversity and inclusion, the news is not great. It doesn't feel great. We haven't yet seen the beautiful return that it's, that's really at the end of the inclusion rainbow. And there's very good science around what that is, which we get into in the book. This idea of you know, common information effect. Mm-hmm. And if we just bring in difference and we don't account for it, we're actually going to be less effective than these teams that are more similar to each other. And so really, as Francis said, it is about intentionally creating an environment where you're not just bringing in diversity, but you are learning how to invite that diversity to contribute their unique information and insight and capability and talents to the shared mission. And I think what we're seeing, I mean, this is a almost absurd time also in the American conversation, right, about diversity and inclusion. Right. But when you really get into organizations that are getting it right, it's incredibly exciting how those organizations are outperforming people who aren't there yet. And what we are on the sidelines cheering for is that there are some organizations that are on the way and that they're in the inevitable frustration and discomfort of getting the diversity and difference right, but they haven't really tapped into the full power of that diversity. And a lot of the work we do is cheering people on and helping them very tactically keep going down the path. And when we wrote about Wednesday, we really had those organizations in mind. We do make the case for the payoff of inclusion at the beginning, but it's really inviting people who are on the path to keep going. And here's what it looks like. And here's what's at the end of the rainbow when you get it right.
Yeah. And it's not easy. I mean, that's another thing.
No, it's hard work.
To learn. And I think, Kelly, the reason it's not easy, if I was going to substitute a word for easy, it's not instinctual. Mm. It is a learned behavior.
Yeah.
But as soon as you realize that, I mean, learning can be easy if you realize you have to learn it. So it's what I'd say is it's not instinctual. And
yeah,
when you realize it's a learned behavior, you can learn it like we learn how to do everything. We just have to include this in one of the things we learn how to do, because it's also, once you put on the glasses for it, it's so clear. It's so, I mean, oh my goodness, there's not like, oh, I'm going to interpret it this way, but you might interpret it that way. Oh no, there's not two ways to interpret it. It's so, the evidence just piles up and piles up and piles up.
I love Dolly Chugg's approach to this. We were talking about Apple, and she talks about, you know, wouldn't it be great if our approach to DEI were like we're updating the software on our iPhone?
Yeah, she's totally right, because we, so many of us leave our instincts at play, and our instincts came with, you know, who we grew up with, like what our life's experience is. So our instincts aren't our fault, but limiting ourselves to our instincts, that is our fault.
Thursday, which is about telling a good story. I had a playwriting teacher once. I will never forget this advice she gave to me. She says, if you can't tell me your play in a sentence, you don't have a play. And I think that very much coincides with your idea of understanding deeply to describe simply.
Yeah. And it's, this is the one where we, so many of us, when we finally understand something deeply, we don't do the extra work to describe it simply. We describe it in all of its glorious complexity.
Yeah.
And without realizing that that narrows the people that we can talk to and influence to a tiny sliver of the world. And so if we, once you understand something deeply, you're halfway there. And then we have to spend the other half of the time describing it simply. In fact, the kindest thing that someone can say is, well, that seems obvious. Successful. Great. Thank you.
Yeah, we love the example of John Legere and T-Mobile, who really told the story of that company's turnaround in one word that he essentially made up, which was uncarrier. And it's so powerful because at the time, everyone hated their cell phone company for very good reasons, because the contracts were terrible and the service was terrible and you were locked in for generations and your firstborn child had to be put up for collateral. Mm-hmm. And then he came in and he said, we're going to build something different. And he activated not just the organization around this idea that we're going to be the uncarrier, but also consumers. And he told that story really powerfully. So I love your one sentence challenge. Mm-hmm. And there's precedent for getting it down to a single word.
Yeah. Another thing that was sort of interesting, you talk about this idea of Cantor's law, which posits that everything looks like a failure in the middle. There is a rule in improvisation that you need to start in the middle. So the idea is rather than start with a bunch of exposition, introducing yourself, get by that. No one's interested in that. Get right to, you know, the action of where you are, everything else will follow from there. So it's like we spend so much if you spend a lot of that time digging a hole or searching for something, it's like, nope, get into it. And what you'll notice with really brilliant improvisers is they come in with these sort of audacious ideas just right off the bat to see where it goes from there.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really powerful.
You know, yeah. And we call it Cantor's Law for, it's Rosabeth Moss Cantor, so person. Mm-hmm. Is Cantor's Law. And I think if anyone was privileged enough to follow Rosabeth around for a day, you'd have the Ten Commandments. You'd go from laws to command. Like you would learn so much in just one day with Rosabeth.
Love it. All right. So Friday is go as fast as you can. And you say, quote, there is such a thing as being too late. Talk to me about the speed and why that's, I mean, you talked about it at the beginning as being important, but you've made it Friday. And is that because ultimately we take our foot off the gas?
Well, Friday's the payoff.
Yeah.
You know, you've worked hard all of this entire week, and then you've earned the right to move fast because you're far less likely to break things. So some organizations comes from a good place, but with a sense of urgency, jump to Friday. And that's where this idea of move fast and break things was born, because what our work has convinced us, and we believe has shown persuasively, is that, yes, speed is essential to change leadership. But it, in order to do it well, you really need to build it on top of a foundation of trust. So Monday through Thursday, you are laying that foundation. Now, when you get to Friday, you can sprint, and there's, you know, we spend a lot of time, we talk about the tactics, we talk about the strategy, we talk about removing roadblocks, and you get to do all of that, but you really have to get through steps 1 through 4 for all of that stuff to work in a sustainable way.
I'm reflecting, when we create shows at Second City, it's normally about a 10-week process. So the new cast gets together with the director, and then that first 3 weeks, 4 weeks is completely yes and. It is all about, we're going to try every idea, no matter what. It doesn't matter how stupid, how crazy, how what, we're going to try it. And then it becomes, and we're doing this, of course, in front of an audience. So iterating, hearing what the response is in real time. And then we're using that latter part to condense. And then the last 2 weeks is all about sort of ruthless editing and sharpening and honing and, you know, everything on stage. And it feels to me a little bit like what you're talking about here is that you know, 10 weeks can seem like a lot of time. It can seem like no time, but it's the time that we have, and we all know right. it. So that is there. And then there is this progression that you have to admit, because you can't do the thing in week 9 and week 10 that you do in week 1. It will throw everything off. So I think there's also, as I'm thinking about this now in your book, it's very much of like these are, and the steps will intertwine, right, at different yep. times. But overall, no, there's an arc.
Yeah. You know, what you just described, if I was going to give it a corporate parallel,
yeah,
it's how meetings are run. So a ineffective meeting is one where you call on the first person, you call on the second person, you call on the third person. And if they repeat each other or say things similar to each other, or they say things different, it's you hear everyone's voice. That's a very ineffective meeting. Even though it sounds nice, it's terrible. Uh-huh. Instead, what you want to do is hear all of the ideas. And it sounds like that's what you're doing. So a meeting, when the first person speaks and then the facilitator says, who can articulate an alternate point of view?
That's right.
And then who can articulate? And so what you said, which is so crucial, is you're going through all of the ideas. You're not getting everyone's idea. You're going through all of them, because a lot of people have similar ideas.
And, that's right.
And meetings, oh my gosh, if we could just edit the meetings and take out all of the duplication, the 60-hour meeting would probably take 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's the start in the middle. It's, again, get me to this. And as we know, the research, too, is that I think Bob Sutton was saying this to me, that something like a couple thousand ideas for the one that might work, again, seems daunting. It isn't if you actually recorded what you're, because what are we making? How many decisions are we making in a day?
Right, yeah.
So many. Yeah. It's an orientation. And then, of course, because that's hard work, it's cognitively difficult, we need the weekend to chill.
Yes, you got to take the weekend off. Well, it's interesting. We wrote Friday knowing that some people would skip ahead.
Yeah.
And we were hoping that by the end of Friday, we would win them over enough that they would
go back
to Monday and see if we had anything else useful to say.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that it's a non-negotiable. And we weren't the ones who said there is such a thing as being too late. It was Dr. King who said that.
Yeah.
And we get really serious about this question of speed, because the clock is ticking. It's ticking on our lives. It's ticking on our planet. It's ticking on our organizations. And when we take our time and don't deal with the biggest questions with a sense of urgency, there is a very real price for that choice.
You know, I would add to that, or add some poignancy to that. Like, let's say one of your problems is that certain groups in your organization aren't given access to thriving the way others are.
Yeah.
If you take too long, it's at the human cost of those individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are deadly serious about the need to go fast, but not without Monday to Thursday, or else you will fulfill Mark Zuckerberg's promise of moving fast and breaking things.
Yeah. All right. We always end the podcast for our first time guests, and you're one, asking for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yes, Kelly, I'll give you two. I'll give you a professional and a personal. So a recent yes and. So I'm the writer in the relationship. So I prefer a very controlled environment where I can go away and think about exactly what words I'm going to use. And we were months, I'm being generous, years late in the deadline for this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was invited to do a TED Talk, and it was a ridiculous thing to say yes to given the amount of work that was involved. And I decided to do it and to lean into my own discomfort with it. And the outcome of that, of the whole process in terms of community and getting better at things and even improving the ideas. And I credit this incredible curation team and our curator, Corey Hageum, for making it happen. really challenged my own relationship with discomfort. So I learned a tremendous amount about that. The personal example happened last week when my sister-in-law, Zoe, invited me to go to a Taylor Swift concert on the other side of the country. Nice. And it was a totally ridiculous idea. Mm-hmm. And I've decided to go, and I will report back on how it turns out. But I'm already excited to be participating in this phenomenon that really feels like an American revival in 2023. I know. That's what I've been told. But I will report back on it. But I'm already feeling like this was the right call.
I love it. I think first Taylor Swift, yes, and the history of the podcast, which I'm very excited about because I'm a huge fan. Francis, you've been on the podcast before. So for returning guests, we actually asked them to tell us a thank you because story. And as listeners to the podcast know, of course, this is our research with Heather Caruso at the University of Chicago, now at Yale, or at UCLA, pardon me, around the idea of how do we continue to engage with people that we maybe don't agree with. So I'm curious if you have a thank you because story for us.
But I'll just start with the hypothetical. If our sister-in-law Zoe asked me to go across the country, I would have had a thank you because. Thank you, because I can tell how much you love me.
But you will not be
but
going.
There's no freaking way I'm coming with you.
So,
but thank you. No, I don't know where this lands.
No, I think that's fine because you appreciate the
appreciate
it was a gift.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's a gift. So, and the one that's happening more in my life. So I grew up in a family of that was filled with judgment of others. So a mm-hmm. connoisseur of judging. And pessimistic judgment. And I much prefer optimistic curiosity. So when I'm with my family a lot, and that's been the case this summer, I started by being so frustrated by their pessimistic judgment and like trying and knowing it, like knowing it, like just trying to correct it and trying to correct it. And then when more recently, when I have converted, anytime I hear them telling me things that have pessimistic judgment, I convert it to I love you in my mind. And I just hear I love you. And it's thank you, for looking out for dangers for me.
Yeah.
Thank you for being concerned. And so I think my thank you because is just hearing I love you, even though the transcript might point it out as pessimistic judgment.
That's a real powerful reframe. And a gift to yourself.
I benefit tremendously, and it makes me more fun to be around.
Yeah, which is important. Yeah. The book is called Move Fast and Fix Things, The Trusted Leader's Guide to Solving Hard Problems. Francis and Anne, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Oh, Kelly, loved it.
We loved it. It was our pleasure. Thank you.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survives.
Survive.